9:30 p.m. Again, that's Portland Chinatown's 5th annual Lunar New Year Dragon Dance Parade on Saturday, January 25th from 11:30 a.m. to 3:30 p.m. The parade begins at Northwest 3rd and Davis at 11:30 a.m. and the activities and performances begin at 1:30 p.m. at the Oregon Historical Society, 1200 Southwest Park Avenue in Portland. Information about the parade route, performers, and sponsors can be found at kvu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Good morning. You are listening to KBOO Portland. It's 10 o'clock, top of the hour. And coming up a little later in the morning at 11 on stage and studio, Dimae Roberts features the Fertile Ground Citywide Festival of New Works with actress, director, and writer S. Renee Mitchell. And 11:30 on Art Focus, Joseph Galavan interviews John Weber about his new job as executive director of the Jordan Schnitzer Museum of Art at the University of Oregon in Eugene. Don't forget that you can hear all of these programs after they air on KBOO.fm or on iTunes and Google Play. Want a third way to listen to all your favorite KBOO programming? Then download our mobile app today. And now, as part of the Hindsight 2020 KBOO's Day of Special Programming, we have Totality of Circumstance. It reviews police community relations over the last 3 years.
Thank you, as always, for listening to KBOO Portland, your community radio station. This is an hour-long Hindsight 2020 special of Totality of Circumstances, a show focused on police-community relations from the people's perspective. We're going to spend the majority of the show focusing on the first year or so after the election of 2016, up through the beginning of 2018. The past 3 years have been a time of extreme political polarization and increasing distrust in institutions, presided over by a divisive, racist, pot-stirring president. It's no surprise that times like these would see increased public scrutiny of police, and conflicts between police and citizens that play out in the streets, courtrooms, and media. In Portland and much of the rest of the country, however, the current climate of scrutiny around policing has only intensified in the Trump years. It began long before. In Oregon alone, the tension between law enforcement and the rights of citizens goes back to the state's colonial period in the early 1800s. That tension hasn't been cut for 200 years, unless you're part of a subset of white folks whose privileges and well-being have been the driving purpose of state and federal government for that whole time period without interruption. For the purposes of this hour, though, it could be said with plenty of complications that the current era of activism around policing is grounded in the early 2010s, when individual instances of officers killing or mistreating people of color and people thought to be having mental health crises began to be widely disseminated across the media. These events inspired people across the nation to learn about police violence and the systems that support it, and to start and join and support activist movements. As a result of this and other movements, there was also a parallel conflict with law enforcement over the tactics of crowd control, especially in Portland. The Trump years have intensified other elements of this, including open white supremacist organizing and demonstrating, glorification of state violence, demonization of poverty and non-white people, and a hostility to public scrutiny that goes all the way up to the top of the federal government and back down again. Those years officially began in January of 2017, but in Portland, the election of 2016 was a moment that defined what we would see after in a number of ways. Most obviously, we had a new president, new mayor, and progressive changes on city council, and large protests when the election results were announced. But there were other changes under the surface, too. The city and its powerful police union, the Portland Police Association, reached a new collective bargaining agreement amidst violent clashes between police and demonstrators at City Hall. The Community Oversight Advisory Board, or COAB, collapsed under the weight of internal disagreement and official neglect. It had been set up to monitor the city's obligations under a settlement agreement with the U.S. Department of Justice, which had found the Portland police engaged in a, quote, pattern or practice of excessive or deadly force against people experiencing mental illness. While all of this was going on, the election inspired a wave of activist mobilization across the political spectrum. Activists and police had already clashed in Portland City Hall in late 2016 as the police contract neared approval, Within a month of Ted Wheeler starting his term as Portland mayor, council meetings began to frequently see interruptions from protesters, sudden recesses, and police calls. This report is from a January 25, 2017 council meeting, Wheeler's fourth. It was shortly after a homeless infant was found dead, and protesters were bringing their outrage to council chambers.
The protesters gathered shortly before 9 a.m. outside City Hall to hold a memorial for the baby, which included speeches critical of city policies they say led to the death, as well as to the deaths of four other homeless people during the recent stretch of freezing weather. The group walked into chambers during its weekly Wednesday morning council meeting, where protest leader Mimi Gurman went to the front and started talking. She carried a tiny white coffin covered in flowers and interrupted the mayor as he read the rules for public testimony during meetings.
If folks would like to show your support or displeasure for a particular item or comment, please do so with a thumbs up or a thumbs down so that no one is disrupted, but we can see your expression. Carla, please call up the first citizen for communications today.
Are you here to disrupt this meeting?
If you're disrupting this meeting, then you are treading on other people's ability to speak. You're out of order. We're going to take a recess. Let's take a 10-minute recess.
That 10-minute recess turned into 40 minutes, during which City Hall was put on lockdown while a small crowd of media, Black Bloc demonstrators, and security gathered outside. Wheeler returned around 10 a.m. and said he would meet with the protesters after the meeting in the park across the street, if they left the chambers promptly, and threatened them with arrest. Most of the protesters left, while two dozen policemen filed into the building. Those who stayed behind to testify prompted Wheeler to call yet another recess when they refused to stick to the topic at hand and kept bringing up neglect of the homeless, police accountability, and the unresponsiveness of the city council to these and other concerns. Here is Star Stauffer testifying on a proposed street improvement project in Northwest Portland.
I'm ashamed right now that this is the representatives of my city, that is a more pressing issue, and how to spend that money on those projects and have another gentrifying developer come in into my community that my father and grandfather built with their hands and callously talk about bike lanes and street cracks when there's a baby dead. So, shame on you.
Thank you.
That was Star Stauffer, one of the demonstrators at today's city council meeting, seeking to draw attention to the deaths of homeless people on Portland streets. After more testimony, including Wheeler cutting the microphone on several of the demonstrators, the rest of the meeting went off with few interruptions. I'm Sam Bowman, KBOO Evening News.
Mayor Wheeler would grow even less patient with protesters during his first year in office, eventually taking a series of measures to cut down on citizen participation in council hearings. The security firm G4S began checking bags and wanding people at the door. Rules were put in place allowing council to eject disruptive people and issue two-month exclusions to repeat offenders. There were also quieter procedural changes, like no longer holding hearings with public comment when reports were presented to council, including, for example, audits of the police bureau. The killing of a young Black man on Northeast 82nd Avenue on February 9, 2017, significantly ratcheted up the tension between the community and the city in council chambers and at protest actions across the city. Quanis Hayes, a 17-year-old known as Moose to his family and friends, was shot to death with an AR-15 rifle at close range by Portland police officer Andrew Hurst. Here, KBOO's Jenna Yokoyama speaks with a member of the PSU Student Action Network about planned protests soon after the killing of Quanis Hayes.
Last Thursday morning, 17-year-old Quanis Derek Hayes lost his life at the hands of Portland police. This Thursday evening, the Portland Student Action Network will be holding a rally called Justice for Quanis Hayes. The rally is being held to honor the life of Hayes as well as to hold the Portland Police Bureau accountable. With us in studio is Portland Student Action Network organizer and friend of Hayes, Shamiah Ibe. Thank you, Shamiah, for coming in, and condolences to you and the Hayes family. For this Thursday's rally there at the Park Blocks, you're going to be honoring the life of Quanis, and you also say that you're going to be holding the police bureau accountable. Can you talk a bit about the student network and wanting to hold the police accountable for Quanis' death?
Yeah, most definitely. This officer isn't the first of his, I guess you would say, bad behavior. or bad cop behavior. He shot a mentally ill person back in 2013. And we just, that shouldn't have even been allowed. He shouldn't still have his job. And it needs to end with Qantas.
And have you been a resident of Portland for like your whole life? Or?
Yeah, I've lived in Portland all my life. I'm 18 years old. So.
And so for you as someone who has been here in the city and now is having to go through this personal tragedy, what do you want to let your city leaders know in terms of holding the city accountable and getting justice for Qantas?
I feel like the mayor is behind us, and that's a good start, but we need more people. Like, we need the chief of police to be accountable and on our side. And what we really just want is like support and solidarity to recognize that this is a traumatic experience for his family, because the police are supposed to protect us, but they're killing our friends and our family and our brothers, and it's not okay.
Yeah, the initial reports that have been told by the police and have been in the major media narrative have really been sort of painting Qantas as somebody who was a suspect, very much like a criminal. And I'm just wondering if you, as someone who actually knew him personally, if you could speak about what it is to see him being characterized that way.
It hurts because he was such a good person. He's so respectful and nice to anyone he came across. He's like, if you really knew him, he was just, his just presence just lit up a room. Like, he was just the light of the party. Like, I don't understand how this could have happened to Qantas. He didn't deserve this, and he doesn't deserve his name to be dragged through the mud like this. He was a young boy, and he was so close to graduation, and you guys took that away from him.
That was KBOO's Jenna Yokoyama speaking with PSU Student Action Network's Shamaya Eden about a planned protest in the wake of the police killing of Qantas Hayes in February 2017. An open community funeral was held for Hayes on March 24th of that year at Philadelphia Community Missionary Baptist Church, not long after Officer Hurst was found justified in killing him. It was presided over by Pastor Roy E. Clay, and the KBOO Evening News was there.
What happens when a boy dies, cousin?
Yeah. Come on.
At some point, y'all gotta stop playing with these people like they playing with y'all. Young men, young women, they ain't playing with y'all lives. Don't look at this casket and just think we lost moves. We lost moves. This is the reality of the war that's on y'all lives, and y'all still playing with these people. Y'all still acting like the Portland police and other police bureaus around this nation look at young black men differently. That's a lie. At some point, enough graves have to be set for y'all to get serious about the reality. Qantas, Clayton, son, I love you, man. I swear I wish I'd have just gotten your helmet when I got home. Not because you was doing wrong, but because I understood that the minute you left by yourself, they would take your life from you. I swear, as God is my witness, Clayton, your life will never be forgotten. And your legacy, this city legacy, is now you, cousin. They will eat of their destruction of your life, and we will do all we can to seek justice.
Quantas Hayes!
A few weeks later, KBOO's Teresa Mitchell spoke to Donna Hayes, Qantas's grandmother, outside of City Hall.
Qantas Hayes was fatally shot by police officer Andrew Hurst in February with an AR-15 rifle. Hayes' family, along with Don't Shoot Portland and other community organizers, are demanding that the case be put before a federal court. KBOO's Teresa Mitchell spoke with Donna Hayes, Qantas Hayes' grandmother, about the case.
You tried to talk to the city council earlier today?
No, that was last Wednesday.
Last Wednesday.
Uh-huh. And so they wouldn't let me go at 2 o'clock, neither time. So what we did, we went over to the process and got a councilwoman to okay it. And so I got May 24th at 2 o'clock. They told me 10:05, but they changed it to 2 o'clock, which I'm glad. Because, the gentleman that was, it's the anniversary of a man that was, a young man, I think he was like either 22 or 25, was killed by police. They drug his name through the mud, talked about he was, had a felony, and that he was a criminal and drug addict. But they shot him, okay? They say they give a warrant. So they having that on the 24th, so they'll be able to come. After that march, they have it on the 24th because it's at 2 o'clock. But for me, I'm looking forward to coming to the city council because I let my daughter do the talk. It was her child that she lost. But I lost something, too. That was my grandchild. That was a close grandchild of mine. You know, he's up in age. We could talk. We had an understanding. You know, I knew he loved me. And I lost him on his knees with his hands in the air. I read the transcripts. It's so many conflicting views. In the last one that I read, because I haven't went past 275, I'm having a hard time with it, the chief came down and said, well, when they lied, it said, oh, only one person was speaking at the time. The chief said, I heard everybody speaking. So we got a child on his knees with his hands up in the air, confused. They got a person, the only person with a lethal, that does lethal, lethal weapon, was a person that had it last time that the government is in on because of him. You know, why would they give him a gun? They could have gave anybody on the planet a gun other than him. Let him hold a beanbag or the taser. Because I'd rather see my grandson hit with a beanbag, whining and complaining about how slow he is. Or the taser that he'll remember to chill every time he think about it. I'd rather have that because he would have been alive. We'd have had something to talk about. Yeah, I told him he was on his knees. They gave different descriptions of he was squatting, he was on his knees, he was on his belly. What's true? We had one policeman saying, let me go through my notes. So he got notes. What I don't understand is the grand jury process. I don't understand it. It's one way for policemen and another way for other people. Because other people, you cannot be there. You cannot have a lawyer there. But he can be there. He had his lawyer there. He had the union there.
So he had and representation, and we had none. He was my great-grandson. There was none. We weren't there. We weren't permitted to participate in it at all.
And now the big lie that's going around now is the police officer said, I told him that he shouldn't be carrying a replica gun. That's a lie.
Okay. Was it the same cop that shot him with a rifle that said that?
No, this was another female there. I talked to that lady. She talked to my daughter on the night that my grandson was sitting in a stolen car. His friend had stolen a car, and he's sitting in the passenger seat. That's all he was. That's all they told us. Oh, he was just sitting in the passenger seat. We're sending him home. So he was coming to my house. I'm staying with my mother. He was coming to our house. I had called his uncles and everybody coming. Come on and get Moose because he can't stay here. It's not enough room. First of all, he never made it to the house. After they said that they seen him, I called a couple of times. They said, oh, he should almost be there. But he never made it. But never once did they mention a replica gun. I think that would have been important to tell his mother he's sitting in a stolen car with a replica gun. But they didn't tell her. So I don't believe he had a replica gun in that car.
So you are calling this afternoon. You're calling for a national investigation.
Yes.
That's what we want.
The federal government to investigate. This is bull. This is the same man they had to come in and investigate before. So I don't understand why they're not jumping into this right away. We got big idiot back here shooting up people again.
But yeah, they filed suit against Portland, the federal government, for the same thing, misbehaving with the police.
And it involved that man, Andrew Hurst, and two other people. It involved them. And now he's back into another one. And they should be back. Because I guarantee you, give him 3, 4, 5 more years, somebody else going to be die at his hand. You know, that little boy, Christopher, I cannot pronounce his last name. We got a blog, a little article, and he gone and he puffed the magic dragon. He's gone. We don't hear nothing else about it. How I found out that he's still in people's mind was I'm sitting on Facebook again, and they're having a memorial 1 year from his death. All these shootings, I think it's all what they're doing to keep it quiet because they don't want to mess with tourism. They don't want to mess with the people that's coming and moving in. Them big old tall buildings they're building in North Portland, Northeast Portland, they got to be filled. We can't afford them. So they got to be filled. So let's not scare the people. Let them keep coming.
That was Donna Hayes speaking with KBOO's Teresa Mitchell in March of 2017. Towards the end of that clip, she references the killing of teenager Christopher Kalonji by Clackamas County Sheriff's deputies in early 2016 and the upcoming anniversary demonstration in his name. Hayes would soon connect with Kalonji's mother, Irene Kalonji, and several other families and activists that had lost loved ones to state violence to form a community group called Pacific Northwest Family Circle. Family Circle, Don't Shoot Portland, Portland Equity in Action, Standing Up for Racial Justice, and other community groups fueled increased scrutiny of the role of district attorneys, police unions, and other background actors in the lack of accountability for cops who kill and mistreat civilians. KBOO reporters tracked the uses of deadly force by cops in Oregon during the years 2018 and 2019, and noticed a sharp increase during those 2 years in the number of instances of deadly force and people dying in police custody. In the 10 years 2010 through 2019, there were an average of 25.6 deadly force incidents across the state, resulting in 13.6 deaths. Both statistics peaked dramatically over the past 2 years, with 43 incidents in 2018 resulting in 21 deaths, and 35 incidents in 2019 resulting in 22 deaths. This was up from 27 incidents and 12 deaths in 2017. Political violence also escalated during these years, especially that driven by white supremacists. In late May of 2017, a man stabbed Ricky Best, Taliesin Namkai Meche, and Micah Fletcher on a MAX train after they interrupted his racist threats against two young students of color, one wearing a hijab. Best and Namkai Meche were killed. Public attention quickly zeroed in on an upcoming right-wing demonstration to take place in front of City Hall. Attempts to convince Mayor Wheeler to revoke the permit for the rally in the wake of the MAX killings were thwarted by the federal government, which owns Terry Schrunk Plaza. The rally was met with three large contingents of counter-protesters surrounding Schrunk Plaza on three sides. The two sides were mostly kept apart by several law enforcement agencies in full paramilitary power. The following report from this event betrays where my head was at in 2017. This was all pretty new or recent for me, which is clear from my liberal use of the word Antifa to describe different organizations and individuals wearing the same clothing, to my general focus on the spectacle and the potential for violence. The rally yesterday in Terry Schrunk Plaza brought in a number of right-wing groups and political strains, from the so-called Patriot Movement to belligerent white nationalists to families from Kaiser wearing Trump hats. It was not scheduled to begin until 2 p.m., but by the time KBOO reporters arrived at 11:30, groups were already setting up in the plaza and across Madison Street and Chapman Square. In Chapman, dozens of black-clad, masked, anti-fascist protesters were talking, blasting music, setting up their medical space, and giving away free ice cream.
At City Hall, across 4th Avenue from Shrunk Plaza, only a handful of people were setting up for the noon rally. However, soon after noon, this had swelled to probably 200 or 300 people as the police cordoned off the sidewalks around Shrunk Plaza across the street.
About 12:30 p.m., hour and a half before the alt-right rally is supposed to start. Everything's pretty much underway, though. Well, we're in the middle of the rally against hate. Portland United against hate, I should say.
Organizers for that rally, called the Portland Stands United Against Hate Rally, contacted the other two counter-protest rallies ahead of June 4th to ask that they respect its nonviolent intentions. The other rallies are the Anti-Fascists, or Antifa, set up in Chapman Square, and the smallest rally, Portland Labor United Against the Fascists, which was about 100 strong at any given time during the day, and set up across 3rd Avenue from Shrunk Plaza. At the corners of the labor rally where 3rd Avenue intersects Jefferson and Madison Streets, there was an interminable series of interactions between counter-protesters and individuals or groups coming over from Shrunk Plaza. At one point, one of the labor organizers began this chant.
We are here to give voice to those that the fascists would destroy, but they cannot. I'm going to read the names of some of the ones that we will not forget today. Juanice Hayes.
We will not forget.
Ricky Best.
We will not forget.
Taylorson Namkai Meche.
We will not forget.
Mulligata Sarah.
We will not forget.
Ricky Best.
Across the street in Shrunk Plaza, right-wing demonstrators could be seen yelling, "Who?" and "I already forgot." While at the labor rally, I saw about a half dozen young men buzz the edges of the Antifa rally in Chapman Square, kitty-corner from us. Many around me identified these men as Proud Boys, a white nationalist group that enjoys, among other things, antagonizing Antifa. It was hard to tell what instigated the interaction, which caused a wave of Antifa to surge towards 3rd Avenue. Later, over in Chapman Square, I asked a bystander named Ethan, who was there as a counter-protester, but otherwise unaffiliated, what he saw.
So you saw some, was it the Proud Boys going by?
It seemed to be, yeah.
Buzzing the edges.
Or? On the corner, they had there were two individuals who came over into a large group of leftist labor folks and just kind of seemed like they maybe wanted a confrontation. One of them had a shirt on that did say Proud Boys. The other one had just kind of general regalia that you might see, a Police Lives Matter flag and a GoPro camera strapped to their chest. And so some folks kind of just interrupted that and led some chants and pushed them out of that area.
I spent the rest of the day moving back and forth between Chapman Square and the labor rally. It was fairly easy to walk along the front line of the Antifa protest facing Shrunk Plaza. City police in full riot gear stood 4 or 5 feet apart, occasionally charging into the Antifa line to seize, in at least one case, a homemade shield. It wasn't all Antifa in Chapman Square either. At one point, I ran into Ibrahim Mubarak, one of the founders and longtime leaders of the Right to Dream 2 camp in downtown Portland. He was standing on the front line holding a sign in front of the police.
I'm with Ibrahim Mubarak. He's holding a sign. What's this say?
It says, "Stop the sweep, we need sleep."
That's a reference to the...
Yeah, to the homeless people, about how they criminalize the people for living on the streets.
And how has this been so far that you've seen? I noticed there was just they charged in for a second.
Well, I think on both sides, they need to learn to accept differences. Everybody have an opinion, and that's your opinion. As long as you're not being derogatory or being discrimination or causing any physically or bodily harm to people, you should be able to say what you want to say.
Further east, near the corner of 3rd and Madison, where most of the altercations that I witnessed occurred, I ran into fellow KBOO reporter Linda Olson Osterlund.
How have things been here?
I think they've been actually great. It's been a continual growth of people against the alt-right. At this point, it looks like on three sides of their demonstration, there are hundreds, I think it's probably thousands of people are down here now at this time against the alt-right and for many other things. And it's great. There's legal here, there's food here, there's medical here, and there's lots of people from lots of backgrounds saying no to the fascists. So I'm really excited.
And
I'm scared. The police are all armored up.
I'm looking at the police. I see DHS. I've seen county folks.
I've seen state troopers, and I wanted to just change that ST to ORM, and it would be stormtrooper on the back of their
Those are the guys on the trucks, right?
Yeah, I've seen them twice deploy them here, but now they've moved them a little away. They've moved them around this corner. I think the area of concern for the police keeps switching from one park to another, and I think that benefits us who want to make sure our voices are heard.
All right. And have you seen any altercations or anything?
No.
Yeah,
I did see one. Someone from the alt-right side, there were like two people behind them. They appeared to want to break through the police line to get into the street, and they were immediately tackled, and they were hauled away, I think, by county uniform, the yellow colored back on the back of them.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you, Linda.
Yeah, thank you for being down here.
I did see some isolated violent incidents in Chapman Square. At one point, when people began shouting, "Rat," and "We've got a mole," a man came running towards the corner of 3rd and Madison out of the Antifa crowd and was eventually tripped and stomped on briefly by about a half dozen black-clad demonstrators before escaping past the police line. This was easily the most extreme bit of violence I saw while I was in Chapman Square. However, not everybody there characterized the day as being overall nonviolent. Ethan, the man I spoke to about the Proud Boys earlier, had this to say.
But overall, you say it's been pretty peaceful.
You know, I might have a counter to that, and I wouldn't say that it's been peaceful.
Oh, yeah.
Just noting that we do live in a police state, and there have been militarized police officers from not only Department of Homeland Security and Multnomah County Sheriff's Office, but Portland Police here that have been visually terrorizing folks and making unlawful arrests. So they also have an LRAD, which you can hear in the background, which is a long-range acoustic device. So I'd say that it hasn't been the show that Berkeley was. There haven't been a mass number of people who have been brawling in the streets.
There you go. Well, thank you so much, Ethan.
Yeah, thank you.
Later, police would round up dozens of people in a so-called kettling maneuver, including journalists and bystanders, and would justify their uses of force against counter-protesters with pictures of makeshift weapons gathered at the site. These events would become a familiar sight throughout much of the next 2 years. It was primarily the use of deadly force against individual civilians, often people of color or people having or appearing to have a mental health crisis, which led community groups to push for an investigation of the Portland Police Bureau by the U.S. Department of Justice at the beginning of the decade. A settlement agreement between the DOJ and the city, finalized in 2014, set benchmarks for the city to reach to overcome a, quote, pattern and practice, unquote, of using deadly force against people in a mental health crisis. While the settlement does not directly address racism or crowd control, these issues often took center stage at public forums and hearings set up to monitor the settlement. After the collapse of the COAB in late 2016, Portlanders had a hodgepodge of options for doing this, including a series of public safety forums held in early and mid-2018. KBOO reporter Jasmine Moneymaker attended a forum held by the settlement agreement's third-party monitor, a consultant group out of Chicago, just over a week after the massive June 4, 2017 protest. Its main goal was to hear feedback on a new report that detailed the Bureau's compliance with the agreement, but many in attendance found ways to use the stipulations of the settlement to talk about how the Bureau's crowd control policy works and how it can be changed.
Last night, the Albina Ministerial Alliance Coalition for Justice and Police Reform, or AMA, hosted a forum in the sanctuary of Maranatha Church in Northeast Portland. The focus of the forum was a review of an outcomes report compiled by the Compliance Officer / Community Liaison, or COCL. The report examines the results of changes made to the Portland Police as a result of a settlement agreement between the City of Portland and the U.S. Department of Justice following a finding for a pattern and practice of excessive force by Portland police. Joanne Hardesty, a member of the AMA's steering committee and host of KBOO's Voices from the Edge, had this to say about the way the report covers protest and protesters in Portland.
There seems to be a disdain for community members who engage in the political process. And you might be forgiven because you're from Chicago, but Portland has a long history of protests. So the fact that we're protesting now is not different than when the war started, is not different than when people are killed on the street. Portland has a history of protests, so I would like you to not use the disdain that I feel in your words when you talk about people protesting. That is who we are. And so it might not be normal for you, but it is normal for us. I also am very concerned that there's been no analysis about the militarization of Portland police officers and how they show up at protests, especially protests led by people of color. Your consulting firm has been totally silent on that issue, and that is a current immediate issue in this community, and it is unfortunate that that has not been addressed in these reports.
Another troubling concern was what the data failed to reveal because it failed to track it. Perhaps the most glaring example of this from the report was that the Portland Police Bureau does not adequately track uses of force against protesters engaged in First Amendment demonstrations.
When there's a protest event, there are force reports that are taken, and there is a event commander who will do a 940 for those force types used.
So then who is responsible for estimating the number of people affected by these force types?
I don't believe it goes off of the number of people. If you're talking at a spray, it's the fact that the spray was used.
So is that like each canister or?
I believe it's each depression would be I'd have to check the specific definitions of it. That's a good question. I'll look into that.
And then who would be responsible for reporting that?
That would be the officer.
So self-reporting?
Yes.
Are there other examples of use of force that might not be included in this report?
If it's a force type that is on the FDC or the force data collection report, then it would be included.
Can you think of any that aren't on that, the force data collection report? Any types of force or any examples of use of force?
Every agency has different force categorizations. I know that with the revisal of the 1010, that the types of force would be better defined. But for the moment, I'm sorry, 1010 is the use of force directive for PPP. I'm sorry, shorthand. But I know that they'll be better defined. But currently, yeah, the force types that are defined on the FDCR are the types that are collected by PPP, and that does vary agency by agency.
Okay, I'm sorry, one last question. Is it part of your scope to make recommendations of the types of force that they would include?
I don't believe we have that authority under the settlement agreement. The settlement agreement specifically says these are the force that will, these are the policy changes that you will make, or these are the parts of the policy that you will retain. But there is no national standard of force type, so it'd be hard for us to make a recommendation.
Thank you.
Are there a particular force type that you're thinking of that might not be included?
I'm just.
Flash bang? Yeah, I was thinking about the flash bombs.
And whatever they shot, rubber bullets.
Pepper bullets.
Pepper bullets. At the last protest.
The rubber bullets would be an impact munition. Don't know about the flashbangs. I would have to check to see.
So I'll just say I don't have it with me because I don't think about this part. But the use of force report, quarterly reports that come out do not reflect the number of less lethal weapons, pepper spray, or other kinds of violence, including pushing people with batons and other violence that was used at the protest. So I would be surprised if what you're saying is in any way true, that every officer who uses force at a protest action files a report and it gets reported?
I've reviewed FDCRs from protest events. I've reviewed FDCRs and 940s from protest events. Oh, I'm sorry. I've reviewed force data collection reports and 940 of the after-action reports that are completed by the supervisor. I've reviewed those documents from protest events.
It sounds like what we need to do is have some kind of community forum comparing the number of those reports that were filed after a specific protest action and the number of uses of force that actually occurred, including, you know, any video documentation, which we probably have in the community.
Actually, that's a really good question, because you're looking at how are you verifying that information? So self-reported by the officers that were at the scene. So are you looking at community video? Are you looking at newscasts? Are you reading articles that actually comparing what the officers are saying, or is it just officers self-reporting?
We've also looked at videos, but you raise a good point. I mean, we haven't gone back and compared all the videos available. It would be an enormous task against the number of force reports submitted for that event. And so I think that's something worth.
Right, I'm over here. And I just want to say that this is a community forum, and I think I'm hearing pretty consistently that the community has some concern about this possible lapse or this chasm between what's being reported and what is actually being experienced. And as a Portland resident, I would concur.
This is Jasmine Moneymaker reporting for KBOO News.
That was a report from a June 2017 forum about the city's compliance with the DOJ settlement agreement. Also percolating in the background during the later part of the year was the city's search for a new police chief to replace the interim chief Mike Marshman. Mayor Wheeler eventually landed on Danielle Outlaw from Oakland, the city's first black female police chief. Outlaw took over much of the practical leadership role by the end of the year, but was not formally sworn in until January 2018 at the Oregon Historical Society during the run of an exhibit about Oregon's, quote, civil rights years, called Racing to Change. KBOO was there.
As your new chief of police, you will see me implementing several strategies that promote positive interactions between police and our communities in order to build trust and legitimacy. We will continue to utilize technology and social media to reduce crime and enhance public trust. And I will ensure solid policy and oversight exist to safeguard accountability and transparency. Additional training at all levels to include the prioritization of de-escalation is crucial to ensure every Portland Police Bureau employee is performing at their optimal level. Lastly, an intentional focus upon officer safety and wellness is paramount to achieving our goals. True community policing is a philosophy that will be interwoven into the fabric of the Portland Police Bureau. It is not a thing, nor is it a box to be checked. Reflecting upon the title of this exhibit, Racing to Change, Oregon Civil Rights Years, I ask myself, is this really a race? And I think the answer is no. As does erosion, trust building takes time. This is a marathon and not a sprint.
Unfortunately, Outlaw won't see the end of the marathon. She passed the baton to new chief Jamie Resch this past December after suddenly accepting a position as the leader of Philadelphia's police force. Another story in the background of police reform news has been the ongoing effort of the Citizen Review Committee to hold police accountable for even relatively minor misconduct. The CRC is part of the City Auditor's Independent Police Review Division, or IPR, and hears appeals of police misconduct cases after officers are let off the hook by official investigations. KABU has been covering the CRC since its founding along with IPR in 2001, but in 2017 the all-volunteer board was entering a relatively dynamic period that would see them challenge several police findings, taking cases all the way to city council over the chief's objections twice. This had happened only once before in the CRC's 18-year history. In this, KABU's Jasmine Moneymaker follows up with another case from December of 2017, where the new police chief agreed with the CRC on an appeal.
In a rare bit of good news for Portland's police accountability advocates, Portland Police Chief Danielle Outlaw has upheld a Citizen Review Committee finding from last month, agreeing with the board that a Portland police sergeant acted out of policy when he lied to an activist and threatened to arrest him for filming the police. The Citizen Review Committee represents the only community authority in Portland's police oversight chain. The 11-member volunteer board hears appeals on cases of police misconduct filed by the public. The case in question dates back to a No Dapple protest in November of 2016. Portland activist Benjamin Carenza was standing on the sidewalk filming the police when he was approached by Sergeant Aaron Smith of the Traffic Division. Smith initially told Carenza that filming the police was illegal, and later that he could be arrested if he didn't stop. In his interview with investigators, Smith admitted that he had lied to Carenza in an effort to get him to stop filming. Here are CRC board members Daniel Schwartz and Julie Falk reading from Smith's testimony during the December hearing.
He says, this is a quote, "I lied to appellant about whether he was going to be arrested or not."
Yeah, and the rest of that quote is, to see if I could get him to do a certain function, action, whatever.
Filming the police is a right protected nationally by the First Amendment and by Oregon law, and for good reason. As Matt Dos Santos, legal director for the ACLU of Oregon, pointed out at the hearing.
Bystander videos are a powerful tool for police accountability. In 2015, the Oregon legislature was so concerned about protecting the right to record that they passed a law, HB 2704, to clarify that civilians can openly record police without permission and without warning the police that they are recording. By passing this law, the legislature made clear that they wanted to send a message to law enforcement about the need to protect this right.
Police officers lying to the public about their constitutional rights has troubling implications beyond filming the police. This is CRC Chair Kristen Malone.
Not only just lying to a citizen, but lying about constitutional rights, right to private search that is recognized, rights of the state of Oregon that is recognized, just to see if you can get away with a lie, just to see if you can keep somebody from exercising their rights is really, really abhorrent. And you do it in a situation where somebody knows their rights, and that's extremely terrible. And let's say you do it in a situation with somebody who doesn't know their rights. Maybe it's not First Amendment, maybe it's a Fourth Amendment thing. Maybe it's I can come into your apartment, you gotta let me in, or I'm gonna bowl you over. I mean, it's just not something that we wanna be doing. It's really scary, and I appreciate that the Bureau has recognized that.
The CRC ultimately decided that the case against Sergeant Smith was strong and recommended discipline. When that happens, the next stop is the chief's desk, where she can either uphold or challenge the findings. Though Outlaw's decision not to challenge the CRC finding in this case is heartening, Matt Dos Santos isn't prepared to heap too much praise on the PPB oversight system, tweeting yesterday that, quote, "The guy literally admitted to lying about the law in order to get Carenza to stop filming. It's a shame that it took the civilian board, along with organizations showing up to express their concern, to get to the conclusion that PPB internal affairs should have reached immediately," end quote. The decision is the first handed down by Outlaw during her four-month tenure as chief in Portland and means that Sergeant Aaron Smith will face undisclosed consequences for his actions. Had Outlaw disagreed with the CRC ruling, the case would have gone to the city council. For Benjamin Carenza, Outlaw's decision marks the end of a year-long odyssey through the city's police oversight process, and he's happy with how things turned out.
I'm feeling really excited. I think this was, a good outcome. It saves a lot of time, it saves a lot of time instead of having to go to city council and fight this anymore. So I'm glad that this has ended, and I'm hopeful that the discipline for these two untruthfulness violations, changes, the way the officer engages with the public.
Carenza also said that he found Smith's history of alleged misconduct troubling. This is not the first time that Sergeant Aaron Smith has been at the center of a CRC appeal. On December 20th, 2014, Smith was policing a prayer vigil hosted by the Albina Ministerial Alliance for Justice and Police Reform when he encountered Don't Shoot Portland founder Teresa Rayford, who was acting as a traffic marshal. According to Rayford, Smith pushed her. According to Smith, he, quote, swept his arm at her hand. When Rayford asked for his business card, he refused to give it to her, though he did eventually give it to another vigil attendee. In 2008, Smith and another officer with the traffic division tackled and tased Portland cyclist Phil Sano. In their coverage of the incident, BikePortland.org reported that Sano had been riding his bicycle in southeast Portland when someone told him to stop. Though Sano said he didn't realize they were police, he slowed down, at which point he was tackled and tased. Sano, who according to a PPB press release was initially stopped because he lacked a front light on his bicycle, was charged by Sergeant Smith with resisting arrest, attempted escape 3, disorderly conduct, and failure to obey a police officer. All charges which were eventually dropped. It is unclear whether Smith received any corrective guidance as a result of his actions. So what consequences does Mr. Carenza think Sergeant Smith should face now?
You know, I don't know if this guy should continue to be a sergeant. I don't think he should be fired. I hate to see somebody lose their livelihood over mistakes of this degree. But I don't know that this guy should continue to be a supervisor of the day shift of the traffic division. He oversees a significant amount of officers, and that concerns me.
This is Jasmine Moneymaker with KBOO News.
Outlaw didn't always agree with the CRC. In another late 2018 case, she disagreed with the committee and eventually lost the appeal before city council, in what wound up being the first time that council not only agreed to reverse a bureau finding, but also agreed on a new finding that resulted in officer discipline. That case wrapped up in May of 2019, and to give you an idea of what people can really expect out of this system, nobody, not even the original appellant in that case, knows how and if the officer was actually disciplined. But the struggle to hold police officers accountable, as I mentioned at the top of the hour, goes back way beyond the Trump years. This was addressed by longtime community activist, founder of Don't Shoot Portland, and current mayoral candidate Teresa Rayford at a live forum held at KBOO on December 1st, 2017.
And so just for me to be able to look at where I am, you know, 36 odd years later, dealing with the same, departments, the union, which now it's Daryl Turner, the commissioner, which is right now it's the mayor, but back then it was Charles Jordan, and he wasn't the mayor. So there has been a position in place where the city commissioners could actually have that seat so that you can reconcile different things with the mayor. And what I saw then was that the city, people from my community were able to make an effort to speak directly to the commissioner and to the mayor in a way that would build some type of response that would entitle them to have oversight, which would entitle them to have some type of commitment from the city bureaus to create some type of accountability or oversight. And now we're just seeing that as resistance. I mean, we're looking at 36 years of that being a part of the positioning of that. Let's say that the Possum incident and then the death of Tony Stevenson, and then several incidents between then. When the Possum incident happened, I'm looking at news footage that I have on VHS, and they're saying that there were over 500 complaints. That incident happened like March 12th or 13th. So for the police to have so many harassment and intimidation and assault complaints and theft complaints against them coming directly from this community of color that I grew up in, I mean, nothing has changed. The only thing that I see is the repositioning of power. There's a lot of appointed leadership that is siding with the police, and they're asking for a policing partnership in our communities. They're looking to establish a relationship with the same system that has never been held accountable for the harassment and intimidation and just straight up white supremacist racist behavior against us. And that's the part that's not making me feel accommodating a reform system would make any sense. How do you reform a system that is just, you know, berating you during your entire existence? People are just now saying that they're seeing white supremacy and racism in our policing force because of Donald Trump. But if we have him as a president, isn't that a reflection of our values?
That was Teresa Rayford speaking at a December 2017 KABU forum on police community relations. One change for the better during the Trump years has been the emergence of family and victim-led accountability movements that confront systems of power with their own actions and complicity. This was on display a year after the killing of Quanis Hayes when the Hayes family, backed up by members of Pacific Northwest Family Circle and other organizations and supporters, rallied in front of Portland Police's East Precinct. Some of the 80 or so people who showed up decorated the sidewalk outside the precinct with the names of people killed by police in chalk, outlined in hearts. The doors to the precinct building were locked despite it being midday. People moved around inside as children and members of the Hayes family pressed up against the doors to look in and demand that police brass come out to talk with them. Donna Hayes called on East Precinct Commander Brian Parman and Captain David Galladay in particular to come out and speak with Quanis Hayes' great-grandmother, who was also in attendance.
Apologize! Come on out here, David! Come on out here, Brian! One of y'all need to come out here and apologize to this woman! She deserves it! Hey! Where are you? Come and talk to me, chicken.
Nobody came out. You have been listening to a special hour-long Hindsight 2020 edition of Totality of Circumstances, looking back at a snapshot of police and community relations in Portland during the first year of the current administration. Stay tuned during our regular slot for more community reporting on police issues every other Tuesday, starting next week at 5:30 p.m., right after the KABU Evening News. I'm Sam Bowman, and additional reporting in this hour was done by Jasmine Moneymaker, Teresa Mitchell, and Jenna Yokoyama. Thanks for listening and for supporting KABU Community Radio.
KABU Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the 2020 Portland Mochitsky Festival on Sunday, January 26th from 11 a.m. to 4 p.m. at the Viking Pavilion in Portland. The Mochitsky Festival celebrates the New Year by sharing Japanese-American culture with the community. The festival features hands-on activities for all ages, cultural foods, vendors, and a wide variety of demonstrations and performances, including taiko drumming, Japanese dance, storytelling, mochi pounding, martial art demos, and much more. Again, that's the 2020 Portland Mochitsky Festival on Sunday, January 26th, from 11 a.m. to 4 p.m. at the Viking Pavilion, 930 Southwest Hall Street in Portland. More information can be found at kabu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Good morning. You are listening to KBOO Portland. It's about a minute before, we're a minute before 11 o'clock. And today we're having special programming most of the day called Hindsight 2020. And we just heard some special programming, Local Politics at 9 and Totality of Circumstance at 10, covering police-community relations. Coming up next, though, is Stage and Studio. Dimay Roberts features the Fertile Ground Citywide Festival of New Works with actress, director, and writer S. Renee Mitchell. And 11:30 on Art Focus, Joseph Galavan interviews John Weber about his new job as executive director of the Jordan Schnitzer Museum of Art at the University of Oregon in Eugene. Don't forget that you can hear all of these programs after they air on KBOO.fm or on iTunes and Google Play. Want a third way to listen to all your favorite KBOO programming? Then download our mobile app today. And now it's Stage and Studio.
I'm Dimay Roberts, Stage and Studio. We're listening to music by Portland musician David Ornette Cherry. Hear his music at davidornettecherry.com. This is the second of three shows featuring original works during the Fertile Ground Festival. It's an 11-day citywide festival of original performances. The festival runs Thursday, January 30th, and continues through Sunday, February 9th. You can find out more about it at fertilegroundpdx.org. We'll be talking about the festival works and how the last 3 years has affected Portland's performing artists. And this is part of KBOO's theme today of Hindsight's 2020, debriefing the last 3 years. Stay tuned for a special Stage and Studio. I'm Dimay Roberts. With me in my studio are Nicole Lane, Festival Director of Fertile Ground Festival.
Hi, thank you for having me again, Dimay.
It's good to see you again. And S. Renee Mitchell, writer,